You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I am truly thrilled to be having this conversation. Today's podcast is with Julia Minson, who is a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. She is a behavioral scientist with extensive research experience in conflict, communication, negotiations, and decision-making. Her primary line of research addresses the psychology of disagreement, how people engage with opinions, judgments, and decisions that differ from their own, not at all relevant in today's society. Her work has been published in top academic outlets and covered by CNN, Time, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The New York Times. She has a terrific new book. It's called How to Disagree Better. You're going to love this pod. Julia Minson, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So about 10 years ago, we developed a program called the Second Science Project with behavioral scientists at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago that looked at improvisation through the lens of behavioral science and vice versa. And I remember having a long chat with one of the academics, and this was as we were developing bespoke evidence-based improv exercises that allowed people to practice a better way to speak through difference. And she said that one of the main reasons she found herself in this work was that growing up, she was essentially the mediator between her parents, who came from two distinctively different cultures. And they'd have regular screaming matches. And so this was her world. You also have a pretty amazing origin story that brought you into this work. Can you tell us about that story or those stories?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is one of those examples of, you know, all research is me search, right? I don't know if you've heard that expression.
Oh, yeah.
So it's funny because both of my parents were psychologists, but they were very different psychologists. I was born in the former Soviet Union, and my mother was a psychologist, and through that work, she met my stepfather, who was an American psychologist. And so they got married, and that's what brought us from Russia to the United States. And so, you know, imagine sort of being in middle school and being thrown into this like completely crazy world where all of a sudden you have an American stepfather, you have American step siblings, you're living in the suburbs of Denver, Colorado, because that's where my stepfather was from. And so, you know, there was a lot of disagreement about everything. I mean, I remember the first time my mom tried to make popcorn, she thought it was corn and therefore ought to be boiled. And she boiled it and boiled it and boiled it and nothing happened. And so my childhood was just sort of full of those sorts of events and the discussions around them.
And then the other thing that you talk about early in the book is that in your previous life, you were a ballroom dancer. And when I read that, I was like, oh, that's just a fun tidbit, but it's not going to be relevant. It is 1,000% relevant to what you're doing based on how you met your husband. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So this also sort of connects to the whole Russia thing. So in Russia, lots of kids ballroom dance, just like, you know, here they do, you know, jazz and ballet and hip hop. In Russia, they all ballroom dance and do figure skating. And so I came to the States already sort of very committed to it and very into it. And the thing that's really interesting about ballroom dancing is that the entire time you and your partner are facing each other, which you would think is like, well, great, of course, how else would you dance? But what that also implies is that when you are seeing yourself, you're looking in opposite directions, right? Like you're literally looking 180 degrees in opposite directions. And so as you are practicing, as you're watching yourself on video, you're just having wildly different experiences. And yet you are physically in the same very, very small space, right? You are touching, you're moving to the same music, you have taken the same, you know, coaching, you're executing the same choreography. If you're serious, you're doing this for hours and hours a day. When you're not dancing, you're watching videos of yourself dancing. And so it is just this crazy juxtaposition of having physically an identical experience, but actually seeing it differently because you're facing in opposite directions.
It's kind of like the illusion of empathy, right? Right? Because you can't help but be that physically close and feel like, oh my God, I'm in you. Because it's akin to mirroring in some respects, but not exactly, because you have this other point of focus, this task that you're doing, which means you can't see from their POV. And if you did, you'd be stepping on their feet, correct?
Right. And it's, you know, it's funny because I think it's quite relevant to most sort of goal-oriented activities that we do as humans, right? So when you think about being empathetic in a work situation or being empathetic to your, you know, spouse, you're not just trying to be empathetic. At that same moment, you're also trying to get the work done or you're trying to get the kids out the door. So your sort of attention and focus is split, you know, between trying to see the world from that person's perspective and trying to be good to them while at the same time getting the thing done. And I think that tension is sort of very, very present in a lot of aspects of our life.
One of the things I loved about this book is you don't pull punches, but you also, you have a good sense of humor and you find the sort of like, the laughs and the comedy inside of all this sort of craziness. You write early in the book, quote, "People like the idea of peace and harmony in theory, but in reality, we all just want to get our own way." I just like, that is so true. I mean, it's like, we idealize this thing, but really it would be so much easier if you just saw I was right.
Right, right. So my advisor used to have a little plaque on his desk that another friend had given him as a gift. And the plaque said, "Be reasonable, see it my way."
I love that. All right, so let's get some scientific terms out of the way early in the podcast. My audience knows about cognitive biases. We've talked about it so much. Let's double down on naive realism, because that's mm-hmm. what is mostly a play here. So what is naive realism?
Yeah, okay, great. So naive realism is a cognitive bias that comes, you know, originally from philosophy. Sort of the term naive realism comes from philosophy. They don't think of it as a cognitive bias, and it got imported into psychology by Lee Ross, who was my PhD advisor, and several of his former students who did this work. And the idea is that people naively believe that their sort of perceptions and judgments and evaluations of, you know, some situation reflect some objective reality that like exists out there, which you're like, of course it does. Like what else do my perceptions and judgments possibly reflect? Mm-hmm. But of course, what we're overlooking is the influence of all the processing that happens between, you know, the stimulus we're observing and our interpretation of it in our brains. Right. And so if you're thinking about kind of physical phenomena, it's, you know, it's pretty easy. Like I see something as red. I forget that somebody with, you know, a different sort of set of eyeballs or in a different level of humidity or in different light would see it as a different shade of red. Right. I just sort of say it's red and I'm done with it. And then we apply the same mindset, kind of the same assumption about the veracity of our assessments to very, very complicated, contentious interpersonal problems, right? So what I think is fair, and what I think is right, and I am the right amount of strict with my kids, and I'm appropriately concerned with climate change, and I'm appropriately concerned with my privacy because I sort of get it. I'm a smart, reasonable person.
you know, it wasn't surprising pretty early on working with the behavioral science community as why improvisation will work, because what we're doing is practicing recognizable human behavior. What emerged was the comedy part, which is different. I mean, improv leads to comedy. That's why we do it primarily, but that's not how it started. It was social work, actually. But the comedy part makes sense when you think about it, because a lot of comedy is about misunderstanding something, right? I mean, it's that thing of like, oh, I thought you were going to say this, or you said this, but you meant that. And it's like that kind of pulling up of the veil is what makes us laugh. And we're laughing. I mean, there's a lot of theories of laughter. And one of them is that release, that uncomfortable release when you figure out that you thought something was going to be this way and then it ended up being another way. You have this test that I took. The receptive mindset. So I scored 5.2 overall.
Above average.
My highest score was in curiosity towards opposing views, which was 6.4. My lowest score was emotional equanimity, where I was 4.0.
Okay.
So what's wrong with me?
you're a person.
I'm a person. All right.
You're a person. That's the biggest problem with all of us. So the receptiveness to opposing view scale was kind of my early foray into this work when I was, you know, studying with Lee during my PhD and kind of trying to understand, like, what's the opposite of naive realism? Because I thought that naive realism was an incredibly profound way of understanding conflict. But also, if you look around the world, some people seem to be better at, you know, talking to folks and engaging with information that seems to be antithetical to their views. And sort of that just like lay observation made me want to capture the essence of what that thing is that makes some people better at this thing. And so we started thinking about this as an individual difference, right? Like some people have more of this thing than others. And what came out is this measure of receptiveness to opposing views that, you know, takes like 5 minutes to do the assessment. It's 18 questions, and the 18 questions are made up of 4 different factors. And so you just named 2 of them. One is curiosity, what we call intellectual curiosity. And, you know, it's questions like, you know, I like to understand why people who disagree with me believe what they believe. And I like reading about opposing views. And I think that's what people sort of associate with being receptive to opposing perspectives. That's certainly where we started, was these curiosity questions. The second thing you named is the factor that actually tends to explain the most variance in our data, and that's emotional equanimity. It's sort of the extent to which you can stay like calm, cool, and collected when you listen to somebody you strongly disagree with. And what I find really interesting about emotional equanimity is, first of all, how little previous scales that have something to do with information processing of opposing views touched on the emotional component. Like if you ask sort of like a random person on the street about conflict, they will probably bring up the word emotions within the first sentence. But most of our scales have to do with like intellectual humility and need for cognition and, you know, actively open-minded thinking. Those are all sort of well-validated scales that never ask people, how mad do you get when you talk to somebody you disagree with? And so what you just picked up on is you can be a very curious person, but then when you follow that curiosity and you talk to somebody or read something that you disagree with, like it makes your brain explode. And so next time you're less curious.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I used to be someone who had National Public Radio on all day long, and now I often have to turn it off. I made the conscious decision about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, to not ever engage negatively in social media. And my algorithms have changed quite a bit. I am not fed as much poison. I'm not taking as much poison. I see it and I feel it, right? It's still, right. And I'm like, but I don't want to partake. And it's hard, especially right. I'm saying especially right now, it's likely always been true. I remember my parents when I was younger and would complain about the Reagan administration or whatever. Uh-huh. Like, you have no idea what 1967, 68, and 69 felt like. You know, uh-huh. I mean, and it was like, I'm like, all right, fair point with that stuff. We get brought into a lot of companies to teach listening. Because obviously as an improviser, you know, you have to be an excellent listener. And the thing that probably surprises our clients the most is when we talk about all the different forms of listening. And really what we're talking about is all the different forms of not listening. That's kind of what's going on. You talk about how TV lawyers explain this a little bit. So I thought that was a really great example.
So, you know, my co-author that I originally did the receptionist scale work with was Francis Chen, who's now a professor at University of British Columbia. And so we were grad students together at Stanford. And, you know, the great privilege of being a grad student is you can sit around for hours and hours and hours and argue with each other about what is receptionist to opposing views. And so initially we thought receptionist to opposing views was, are you willing to, you know, read or listen to a thing you disagree with, right? Sort of like have that algorithm, you know, feed you the thing. And that sounded sensible because you can measure, you know, you can measure physical exposure to information pretty easily, right? You give people a menu of sort of things to read and you see which ones they choose. And the ones who are more receptive choose more items from the menu that are that disagree with them. And then we realized that you can be in the physical presence of information you disagree with, but like completely ignore it. And not just ignore it sort of physically, but try to get it out of your brain as quickly as humanly possible, right? And I think a lot of people can relate to this. If you are sort of being lectured at, right, you sort of think about something else. You're like, this will be over and I will go back to watching the bear and like everything will be fine. And all I have to do is keep my mouth shut for the next 10 minutes and this conversation will end, right? And, you know, the TV lawyers thing, or I think real lawyers are probably the same, at least in this regard. You know, if you are preparing for court, you have to understand the opposing argument. You have to understand it inside and out. So you don't have the privilege of thinking about, you know, the thing you want to do later, because you really have to be thinking about your job, and thinking about your job involves thinking about the opposing argument. But you're not thinking about it to say, well, you know, where could they be right and where could my client be wrong? And, you know, maybe like the truth is somewhere in the middle, because that's not your job. Your job is to find holes in their argument. So that, you know, you do the best job for your client. And so that kind of led us to believe that just being in the physical presence of an argument and just thinking hard about it doesn't mean you're really receptive to it, because you could be like the TV lawyers. You could be thinking hard about it just to refute it. And so then receptiveness became this thing of, you have to expose yourself to an argument physically. You have to pay attention to it. And you have to evaluate it with the same level of critical scrutiny as the arguments from your own side.
All right. So this is a perfect transition into a thing we've talked a ton on the podcast. So first day working with Nick Epley and Eilat Fischbach and all that great crew at University of Chicago, they're like, lead us through like your premiere exercise. And this is the Yes And exercise. It's the title of my book, title of this podcast. And you know, most people know that is simply in improvisation, you know, get anywhere by saying no and not just saying yes. You build with each other that reality and you see where it goes. And it's a way to get to an abundant amount of ideas. There's plenty of research that backs up all the different elements of why that works and things like brainstorming and that sort of thing. But the question they posed to us that day was, we get it, but how do you stay inside a conversation you don't want to yes and? You know, what how do you do that? And for 6 months, we sort of wrestled with this, and folks were looking at the literature, and we were trying out stuff in the classes, and we actually came up with the exercise. And the exercise is called Thank You Because. And what we do is we pair two people, and we say, you're going to have a very low scale argument. Chunky peanut butter versus, you know, creamy peanut butter, dogs versus cats, whether you hang the toilet paper this way, under or over, which actually is actually can start fights. So maybe that's not so low scale. Anyway, so you're going to have that. And you're going to, for first round, you're going to try to convince each other you're right. And we all know what happens, which is no one has ever convinced each other they're right. And in the second, we say, we're going to give you a simple prompt, which is after each of you present your side of the deal, you thank the other person for what they just said. And the because is you just have to find something of value in what they said, even if it is minor. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And voila, interesting conversations, more sense of understanding, more nuance, more laughter. And then you know what we did after we'd done, run this through thousands and thousands of people. We go, well, what's going to happen if just one side does it? Uh-huh. And you know the answer. You know the answer to this, which is same thing.
And
this has become like a stock exercise for Second City. And actually, it's still used in orientation training at University of Chicago for the last 10 years. And it's a very improv thing. But what, so the one thing I want to tell you with this is because I've done this with hostage negotiators at the FBI, old FBI, not the current FBI. The current FBI is not inviting us in. But also with senior law enforcement. Uh-huh. And without fail, there's one guy in that class who can't stand doing this exercise.
Mm-hmm.
They just can't see the need to be right, even if it's about Coke and Pepsi. So that one, tell me what you think when you hear all that.
I mean, I think it's great. And I think it's, you know, what I'm hearing is a few things. One is that you have had a similar experience to what we've had, which is recognizing that when you teach people techniques to have more constructive disagreements, they tend to become contagious. And I think, you know, I think people like having good conversations, like people who say, oh, I just like to have a good fight. Those people exist, but they're the minority. On average, people like to have interesting conversations that don't leave them sort of battered and bruised. And so because like when you hand me, you know, a life raft, you know, a set of tools, I'm totally happy to jump on, right?
Yeah.
So that's sort of the experience we've had as well. You know, and of course, what you're talking about to me closely dovetails with our work on conversational receptiveness, which is, you know, concrete language that allows you to express receptiveness, right? And we also have, I also have this experience. In fact, I just had it in, you know, in a course I was teaching over the weekend where I show people very very receptive language and very unreceptive language. And I say, you know, which one do you like better? And I had a class of 63 students and 62 of them liked the more receptive one. And, you know, the one guy liked the less receptive one. And it's always some version of, I just want you to tell it to me straight.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need you to be nice. I don't need you to, you know, show me respect. Just tell me. And that's, you know, that's a preference. It's just not the preference of most people.
Right. And the other thing, and this has come up in a variety of different kinds of conversations I've had on the podcast with different academics and scientists, which is this, I think we all grow up with this idea of like, well, I got to believe it. Like I've got to know, like it's true deep inside. That if you really examine your life and when things work out, when they don't, it has nothing to do with that. Fake it till you make it is science. I mean, it is,
right. You
just like start, assume some level of positivity and curiosity. And the other thing I think, and maybe this is a thing I just learned because of age and reading and all those things, but it's like, I know it's true in improvisation. We're wrong more than we're right. And when you know that you're wrong more than you're right, you have a sense of like, all right, well, let's just wait and see where this thing goes because I might be missing something. And sometimes in my work, certainly the most exciting discoveries happen by chance.
Right. Well, and here's, you know, here's another sort of another twist on the whole authenticity argument. What I like to remind people is that we all authentically want to have good conversations.
Yeah.
Right. And quite often when I am sort of very annoyed with my counterpart and, you know, not feeling particularly receptive, I'm feeling that way right now. But an hour ago, I had good intentions. And, you know, 2 hours from now, I will regret the way I'm feeling right now. And I will once again wish to have had a good conversation. Right. So which mental state is real? You know, my current annoyance or my earlier receptiveness and my later receptiveness. And so I almost think of it as you have good intentions, just like we all want to eat better and exercise more and, you know, mm-hmm. watch less crap on social media. And so all of these tools are ways to carry out on those good intentions, which are, you know, quite authentic. It's just sometimes, you know, we don't have the willpower to execute them in the moment.
There's a moment in the book that gave me all the feels, so my wife is an academic, and she also works at Second City. So she's a professor and she also does the cooking in the house. I do the cleaning, but it is not uncommon for me to come home and she is in the kitchen and we got the dog and we got like, we're empty nesters at this point, whatever, but there's like lots of stuff going on. And I come in and I have some questions because I'm like, I'm here to help. Right. And I'm diving in and she does not enjoy that. And we both read a lot of these books. We study a lot of this stuff, but you gave names and to these things, because this is exactly what you were experiencing in your household, because it feels like an attack.
Yeah. I always think of it as being like inspected by the general. You know, my father-in-law was in the military, and of course I wasn't there when my husband was a kid, but you know, I imagine that. You know, it's like, do you remember in Sound of Music when in the very beginning the Von Trapp children have to line up for inspection?
Sure.
That's how, you know, it sometimes feels when you're running around and somebody asks you sort of like this barrage of unrelated questions and it feels like you have to report. And that often doesn't go over well when you're all stressed out. But that's a perfect example of a misunderstanding, right? Sort of like born of naive realism, right? I'm having one experience because I'm home and I'm dealing with the kids and I'm dealing with dinner and I'm dealing with the dog and I'm on the phone with grandma. And my experience is I'm stressed and overwhelmed and I don't have the attention to give to one more person, right? And then, you know, the second person comes in, like the second adult comes in and their experience is, I just finished, you know, a work day and battling rush hour traffic to get here. And I'm expecting to walk in the house where I will finally find some peace. And what I find instead is just like raving chaos. And then those two experiences collide and people sort of make interpretations about what is really going on and exactly whose fault it is.
Yeah. I want to tell you about this thing that happened when Nick Epley came to my wife's class to observe her teaching. So Anne's teaching this gibberish exercise, and basically there's a translator in the middle who's going to speak English, but the other two people don't speak. They're going to speak in gibberish. They're from these, you know, made up places, and they're having like a debate, but speaking in gibberish.
Uh-huh.
And the person in the middle will hear the gibberish and then translate to the other person, then back and forth. And it's very funny.
Uh-huh.
And everyone sort of feels like we kind of understand what's going on. And then Nick goes, can I jump in at the end? And he's like, I want to get an idea of how well you thought you were actually understanding the other person. And everyone in all three were like, I think I totally got it. He goes, okay, what were you saying? It was completely wrong. Completely wrong. And part of what Nick was talking about later when he's talking about his research is like the only way we get to actually, because we can't read minds. We think we can't read minds. The only way is by asking a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then this became a thing that you and our mutual friend, Allison Wood Brooks, who seems to come up on the podcast every week because people keep writing books and talking about her. But tell us about this argument that led to a study that you did about asking questions.
Yeah. So Allison and I, you know, have known each other for a long time. She was a PhD student in the same department where I was a postdoc. So, you know, and then we came to Harvard the same year. So she went to Harvard Business School. She ended up faculty at the Harvard Business School, and I ended up faculty at the Harvard Kennedy School. And, you know, and Allison is like an amazing question asker, to the point where mm-hmm. 20 minutes into a conversation with her, you feel like, oh, I've been talking about myself for 20 minutes. And that's probably not good, but here she is asking another question and I can't help myself. I'm just going to keep talking about myself. But, you know, at one point we started talking about like, what's the right number of questions to ask? And her belief was more is better, right? Yeah. Just like ask more questions, let the other person talk about themselves, show curiosity, show that, you know, you really care about their experience. And my belief was, you know, partly based on these, you know, interactions with my husband where he would like pepper me with a bunch of unrelated questions. And partly based on the idea that, you know, somebody tells you that, you know, they like, you know, science fiction and you say, what's your favorite book? And they tell you what their favorite book is. And then you say, oh, well, I just read this other science fiction book. And so it feels like you could make a connection based on shared preferences and shared experience, right? And so I thought that there was some, you know, reasonable number of questions to ask, but it was not nearly as high as what she thought. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we argued about this for like, I don't know, not very long, because I mean, I remember going from, you know, recognizing that we had this difference to let's collect data in, you know, certainly under half an hour, maybe like 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up writing this paper with, Karen Huang and Mike Yeomans. That proved pretty conclusively that she was right and I was wrong. People like more questions.
Mm-hmm. But there's also nuance to that, right? I mean, it can't be just any question.
Yes, there was nuance. And the nuance sort of really explains why we saw it differently. What people really enjoy is what we ended up calling follow-up questions. So we had, right. You know, we had different conditions. In one condition, we told people to ask lots of questions, at least 9. In another condition, we told people to ask few questions, at most 4. And so then we had all these transcripts of conversations that were full of questions. Mike and Karen went through these transcripts very carefully and sort of annotated and categorized these questions. And it turns out that a lot of the magic sauce is, how does this question relate to the last thing your counterpart said? Yeah. So if you say, you know, where you're from, where are you from? And you say, I'm from Chicago. And then I say, you know, what's your favorite pizza topping? That's what we call a full switch question. You just told me you're from Chicago. And I'm now asking you about something totally different. And so I switch topics, ignoring the fact that you might want to tell me something else about where you're from, right? If you said, I'm from Chicago, and I said, what's your favorite thing about your home city? That's what we call a follow-up question. So what I'm doing is I am referencing the answer to the previous question by following up on it. And so the way we thought about it is it's basically a behavioral demonstration of listening, right? I showed you that I sort of cognitively followed, like I still know that we're talking about Chicago. And I showed you that I care about what you want to talk about, right? So it's kind of a form of, you know, expressing some benevolence and goodwill. Like I'm trying to let you have a good time in this conversation by following your preferences.
It's funny. So one of Anne's roommates her roommate at Northwestern was Stephen Colbert. Stephen was in my first cast. I was just talking to him the other day, and it, you know, people are always like, what's it like talking to someone like that who's like in the newspaper all the time and whatever. I'm like, you know what? He is such a supremely good conversationalist and always has been his entire life. I mean, it's like we get on the phone. It is just like, you know, I have some business to do with him. And yet we're talking about like my health for easily like 10 minutes. I'm like, wait. Because it feels good. Because he's actually, and you can actually tell he's listening and cares because he's doing these follow-up questions. And it makes me think of a thing that Anne teaches, because she runs a comedy major. So
when she I wish I was a comedy major.
Oh yeah, no, it's a pretty great. So one of the things she talks about is there's a difference between improvisers and stand-up comedians when it comes to perspective. So with improv, you're doing perspective taking. You're coming to the audience and you have a list of questions for them about like what's on your mind, you know, what's important to you, who are some celebrities that you like, and you're gathering all that up and you're going to spit it back out to them. Stand-up comics, especially in the first 5 minutes of their act, are doing nothing but perspective giving. They have to teach the audience how to watch them. And what do most stand-up comedians do when they perspective give? They talk about their faults. Right? Run through your mind right now. Patton Oswalt's a schlub. Amy Schumer's a slut. John Mulaney is a drunk. I could keep going. It's like that is the beginning of all. And what we're doing is we can tell it's true. We're relating to them and their journey. I think of Kirk Gray's work about shared harm as a way that caused a connection. I think there's a little bit of that in play, right? Because you're doing this with a big group of people. So, you know, and they can sniff it out if it's not real. Right. And I know all these people I've just mentioned, it's all real.
Well, it's vulnerability, right? You're not talking, you know, it could be a real story about some very funny thing that happened to you where you are, you know, you come off as a wonderful person, but the stories are always about, you know, the very successful, very wealthy person on stage also having flaws and life troubles.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we do that, actually, let's go through your HEAR model, H-E-A-R, because I think that's a nice catchy way for people to think about a tool that they can use throughout their day.
Yeah, absolutely. So the HEAR framework is a shorthand for remembering the tools of conversational receptiveness. So what are the words and phrases that help us express our receptiveness in actual, you know, dialogue with people we disagree with? We did a lot of natural language processing to essentially understand from the bottom up what are the words and phrases that people consider to be receptive. But then, you know, it's this massive number of words and phrases, and we had to boil it down to something people could remember. And so we came up with the HEAR framework. So H stands for hedging. It's phrases like sometimes, perhaps, maybe, occasionally, right? So it is a way of introducing uncertainty into your own claim so that your counterpart doesn't feel the need to do it for you. Right. So they're not looking for the one exception to the rule in order to sort of ram it down your throat, because you have already shown that you get that there's exceptions to the rule. So, you know, the example I like to give of the H is I could say COVID vaccines are safe and effective.
You could.
Right. Or I could say most physicians tend to believe that COVID vaccines are largely safe and effective. Right. And so I have just like crammed three hedges into one sentence, but it's actually a truer sentence.
It is. You're right. It's just it's a great example, because talk about emotional stuff coming up with this. It's
The E in the HEAR framework stands for emphasizing agreement. So the idea is that most of the time when I recognize that somebody disagrees with me, my first intention or sort of my first impulse is to get right into that disagreement and, you know, correct them, critique them, tell them why they're wrong, you know, whatever the case may be. Emphasizing agreement means taking a tiny amount of time to find what we have in common. Right. And so that's, I think very similar. You know, it's very similar to yes and.
And thank you because. Yeah.
Because we're saying we're starting from a place of we are on the same side, right? Yeah. And then from that same side, we can figure out all the other stuff. I like to sort of caution folks that emphasizing agreement doesn't mean agreeing, and it doesn't mean compromise.
Right.
It just means that there's something out there that every pair of humans can agree on, right? So it's phrases like, we both agree, or we are both concerned with, or I also think, right? So it's finding something somewhere that we have in common.
It's funny, when the example I use often when I'm talking about thank you because and using it in real world was our daughter got diagnosed with cancer and one of her best friend's parents were anti-vax.
Mm.
Like, what were we going to do? And yeah. So the thank you because I did was I said, thank you because you care so much for your daughter. You don't want her hurt by vaccines. I care so much for my daughter. I don't want her hurt by someone who's unvaccinated. We actually care about the same thing. We care about our daughters. And it deflated all that ugliness that could have happened. The kids could FaceTime and they could text. They could do all that other stuff. They couldn't be in the same room, but they did the other thing.
Yeah. I mean, that is like an incredibly profound example because there's absolutely no stakes that are higher.
Right.
1,000%. And if you can do it in that context, then there's no context in which it can't be done.
Yep. Okay, H-E-A-A.
Okay, the A is acknowledgement. So acknowledgement, I think, is the one that most people know something about, right? It's taking a few seconds to verbally acknowledge your counterpart's perspective. And I think that's the one that has been around the most and therefore has been like butchered the most by kind of popular culture. I think a lot of the times people do acknowledgement by saying something like, I hear you, but here's why you're wrong.
Yeah.
and so there's this like sense of, I'm now supposed to give you credit for hearing me, even though you didn't actually demonstrate that you heard me. So acknowledgement is, you know, starts with, I hear that, or I understand that, or it seems important to you that, or you are saying, you know, X, Y, Z. But then you really have to repeat what the person said. So yeah. I like to think of it as showing my receipts. Like, yeah. Did I really hear? And can I do it justice? And then after I've shown that I heard the other person, that's when I get to go on with my point.
It also sounds like validation, that simply validating, because their feelings are their feelings. Their feelings are true. That's what it is.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I think that's the job acknowledgement does, yeah, is it makes somebody feel validated, feel sort of seen, you know, and I often think about the fact that, you know, the reason we talk is because we want to feel heard. And so once I have shown you with my words that I heard you, now you can stop talking. If I haven't shown you, then you're going to say it over and over and over again until you really feel like I've heard you. You know, and that might involve escalating volume, right? If you're like just really not getting there. So that's the A. And then the R does two things for us. It stands for reframing to the positive. And so it's avoiding contradictory and negative affect words like no, can't, won't, hate, terrible, right? So, and then replacing it with positively valenced words, right? So instead of something like, I can't stand it when people force me to make stressful decisions in, you know, insufficient time, I could say, I really appreciate it when people give me time to consider really important decisions. Mm-hmm. Right. So I just said, I would like more time, but yeah. I've said it in a very different tone that is, you know, that's less likely to sort of take us down this spiral.
There's a phrase you use earlier in the book that applies to all of this when you say language is behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not how we think about it.
That's right. That's right. And I learned that idea from Mike Yeomans.
Oh, that's interesting.
My long-term co-author who really, I think one of the, you know, these days, everybody's sort of analyzing giant reams of language data. But I think of him as being one of the first, you know, 10, 12, 14 years ago as saying, hey, social psychologists run all of these studies on conversation. And what's the behavior there? It's the words, right? It's what we're saying. It's behavior. We're making a choice from tens of thousands of other things we could have said. I chose to say this one. And because it's behavior, you can observe it. And so it's special and we need to study it.
So it's funny. And before we jumped on, we were talking about our mutual friends, but it was 12, 13 years ago that Jennifer Ocker got in touch with me through Adam Grant and ended up bringing a bunch of academics to Second City for a weekend. And my wife, Ann, and I led them through workshops. We went and ate deep dish pizza. We saw Second City shows. We broke down comedy. It was Yeomans. It was Alison Wood Brooks. It was Mike Norton. It was Maurice Schweitzer. It was, you know, that gang, and Jennifer and Naomi Bagdonis. And it was such a magical few days, in part because we were just raw. And this is before we even gotten into working with these folks on this stuff. But everyone could understand and see these rich connections. And I think part of it also was so much shared laughter. Yeah. We made it that it was like throughout an entire weekend, it was almost impossible not to be like, you know, on top of the world with this stuff. So it's so rewarding to see over this decade how the research and the improv and the stuff has found different ways to intertwine. And now other people, I just saw a clip where in the suburbs in Chicago, the group of Downs kids are working with improv folks and ways of finding mm-hmm. connection and support and agency and all those things. It's just terrific. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. Do you got one for us?
Sure. So, you know, we have a very busy, very full household. And every morning starts off with the coffee pot, you know, is set to go off automatically at 6:30 in the morning, because when I stumble mm-hmm. out of bed, I don't trust myself to actually make the coffee. And so then, you know, whoever gets up first gets, you know, the early bird gets the coffee, right? Yep. And then on the weekends, usually the coffee pot is empty by the time the teenagers sort of crawl out of bed at like 11 or noon, mm-hmm. you know? And so one weekend, just a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting there and I'm working and I'm on like my third cup of coffee and it's half empty, but it's the last one. And my daughter comes down and she says, "Mom, can I finish your coffee?" And my first thought is like, hell no. Like, you slept till 11. This is the last, you know, this is the last dredge of mm-hmm. caffeine in the house. And then I thought of yes and I said, "Yes. And then can you go to Starbucks and get us all lattes?"
That's an excellent use of yes and too. Oh, I love it. And she did, right?
Yeah, and she did. Yes.
Everyone wins.
Everyone wins.
The moral of the podcast. The book is called How to Disagree Better. Julia Minson, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you. This was so fun.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.